You're listening to Fakeologist Audio Chat. To connect to our always-on and always-streaming audio chat, go to audiochat.fakeologist.com. This is a new and exciting way to communicate with fellow fakeologists around the globe. Each day we compress and post the day's audio into a file that can be big or small. Discover new voices and ideas that talk about media fakery like you never did before. To listen to the live stream, go to s3.fakeologist.com. Now, on with the audio chat.
It is Thursday, the 14th of June, 2018. Next time I will prepare the date so that I can say it faster. This is Faye speaking. I am on the audio chat live stream of Fakeologist.com, and I'm going to talk about several aspects of a comment that was published by Fakeologist on his website, and which I found very interesting. The comment is by Genevieve. It was written on May 25, 2018, on Cutting Through the Fog, and it is about anti-Semitism and the anti-Semitism psyop. This is a topic that is very important, I believe, because it's very difficult. First of all, it is very difficult to understand what is going on, especially in interpretation of events that are very important that are happening the last decades. One aspect is always Jewish power, Jewish media control in the alternative research community, also, not only in mass media, etc. So there is something that has not been understood, what is going on, which part is propaganda of all that, which part is, it is deceptive, all the topic is deceptive, and it is very important since at least 150 years, so, and I personally have not understood it, so I started just researching also about Zionism and anti-Semitism, and I come from a country where the let's say the popular movements were always very friendly to the Arabic populations of the Middle East and North Africa. This habit changed after the mid-late 1980s with the change in several aspects of the public and political life in Greece. What I want to say with that is, in my impregnation or historical, let's say, experiences, it is, let's say, normal to feel solidarized with Gaza and with the Palestinian population, or, for example, to criticize the apartheid state of Israel, as we call it in Greece. But still, I have no understanding, especially after I started paying attention to the massive scale of deceptions, strategically placed deceptions, not just deceptive practices of anyone or whatever, or strategically produced and distributed psychological operations of the type of 9/11, Charlie Hebdo, Berlin Christmas Market truck attack, London Cube bombing, Madrid train station bombing, etc. I have a more complicated, and maybe that's good, yes, because the situation which we live is complicated, but for example, when a month ago big demonstrations and massive assaults on Palestinians happened near the border to the Israeli state, with allegedly over 100 lost lives. I actually had no chance to interpret this. With interpret, I mean to understand it, what really is going on there. In other days, I just would believe it, to be honest, especially in my Greek life period, where I was living in Athens. I would just take it as a fact, as it is reproduced also by the Palestinian cause leaning media. But now I have a maybe more complex understanding of propaganda and do not trust any of the information. So it makes this whole thing difficult to understand. And this caused, because of that lack of historical knowledge also, what is this whole situation with the Zionism and the Zionism state, or the Zionists, or Zionist media, or Jew-dube, all these things? What does it mean at all? I actually never used these terms in my understanding or interpreting of things, and I am somehow embarrassed.
You're listening to another hour of Fakeologist Audio Chat on Fakeologist.com.
Thank you, Ab, and have a nice day. Well, I was saying that I am embarrassed somehow that vocabulary, or let's say just words, that I thought were no more, or actually never really were en vogue in the thinking part of the populations, let's say, because if you say left, well, doesn't mean anything good anymore. I don't know if it ever meant. But it was never, now it is en vogue again. It is also, maybe I am just paying more attention to that part of information, I don't know, but my feeling is that it is en vogue again, and it is propagated. It is a centrally produced somehow, or coordinated, or organized. It is not by accident. It is not because some people just have these terms and they use them. There is propaganda going on. That's clear. There is a massive distribution of some patterns that I never understood, I never used, but they seem to be very important. And the last, let's say, historical moment where I thought think to have known that these kind of propaganda elements were used was actually prior to the Second World War, the so-called. This I have that knowledge of that period just out of books, of course, because I was not living in that time. I have histories of parents and grandparents that lived through that period, but in the region where my family ancestors, or how is that called, were living, this topic or this thematic was not given. There was a very there were very few, probably, or even maybe none at all, because there are no stories about, let's say, Jewish populace in Epirus. Epirus is that region of Greece where my family stems from. So I thought I will start this as, actually I wanted to prepare it really like an essay or something, but it's also about the the language, but it's also about the really difficulty that I have to find some way to make sense of this whole story. I really cannot make any sense out of it, because it is so, from my point of view, it is so artificial that I cannot approach it in some way. I decided to start just with a text that I have used in my research. And first of all, it's this comment, of course, which I'm going to read and to discuss a little bit about it. As I said, it is a comment on Cutting Through the Fog that runs under the post Defending Miles Matis, which had created some 3,000 posts. That's another story. But Genevieve said on the 25th of May 2018, yeah, that anti-Semitism psyop has been running for a long time, and the global repercussions of it are profound, truly profound, for freedom itself most of all. It was conceived, planned, executed, continually monitored, fueled, and milked to this day by Zionists from at least as far back as WW2. The quote-unquote Holocaust gave it its greatest impetus. Because of that psyop, the anti-Semitism card has put paid to any criticism or outing of any subject or any nefarious deed involving Jews, as it blackens the alarm raisers as Nazis. And we all know what that means, or do we? Thereby, the Jews have been able to gain enormous world power and privilege. So here is one point which I'm going to discuss, because I do not agree with that view. That's the basic reason why I'm going to discuss that. But first of all, I want to finish the whole post, and I'm going through it again to discuss the several points. Thereby, the Jews have been able to gain enormous world power and privilege, was the last sentence. I continue. This psyop has enabled the State of Israel and Zionism to blossom into a very wealthy and dangerous entity with financial aid, political backing, military armaments, and German reparation payments, the list is not exhaustive, of the American and British governments. And you cannot criticize it or cry foul, no matter what it does, however many injustices to humanity, or you incur the Talmudic curse of the Zionists, not to mention, in many places in the world, heavy fines and imprisonment. Decades ago, before this state of affairs had irrevocably shackled humanity, numerous statesmen and politicians had tried to defeat the momentum of it, foreseeing the dire consequences for freedom, but they were utterly destroyed, either by murder or character assassination, so vicious and relentless they took their own lives. This in the face of them being such a small minority of the population. How the Zionists managed this coup is mind-boggling, but they have managed it. The proof is, every single candidate, every victor, as his first deed is to pay sycophantic homage and vow support to Israel. Never underestimate the profound efficacy of control of the media, by means of which the narrative is absolutely controlled. They use the media to suppress, lie, smear, promote, hound, manipulate, and destroy. Divide and conquer played a role, too. In particular, via the two-party political system, that division opens the door for malleable candidates jockeying for victory to be bought and then controlled. And the icing on the cake being human frailties, in particular greed, lust, for anticipated power that, with all puppets, never came to fruition, ambition and egotism, and possibly the worst human frailty of all, the refusal to subordinate one's desires for election and power to the greater good of one's country. That has been the Achilles heel of political aspirants in the once free world that enabled Zionism. And the quest for world government to reach the stage we are now in. Instead of division, we needed unity and self-sacrifice against foreign elements seeking to subvert and destroy and conquer the free world. And we didn't get it, and now it appears too late. What's with that megalomaniacal quest to rule the world? I, for one, don't get it. I'd rather walk on the beach. Nice, this shadow here. Sorry, that was my comment. I continue with the text. It often occurs to me that these days, such is the surveillance and media control, an entire population or an American state or an entire country could be wiped off the face of the earth by the controllers, and the fact of it would never be known if that's how they wanted it. How could we know? Unless you see it with your own eyes. And even then, you could only broadcast the truth of the matter to the outer world if the controllers wanted it known and permitted the transmission of information. For all we know, the entire country of Yemen could have been annihilated last week. That was the comment. Now I'm a little bit unsure if the whole comment was reposted by Fakeologist. Let me see if I can find it. Yes, it's the whole comment. It's reposted by Fakeologist on Fakeologist.com on the 26th of May 2018, one day after the comment appeared, was published on Cutting Through the Fog. I will go back to that. First of all, about the word. Reading this comment, it is clear, generally, that by anti-Semitism psyop, there is one aspect of the whole story that is meant. What is meant is the disability to criticize things that you would criticize if you would not fear to be called an anti-Semite. That is the whole, let's say, model of this anti-Semitism psyop. And that is true. But there are two big problems with it. One is, which bother me, I mean, I don't know if others have a problem, but I am not satisfied with who created it or how was it implemented, how does it work. If it is a psyop, I want to know better how to interpret it and to understand it. I want to localize the modus operandi, or to interpret the modus operandi so that I can distinguish, so that I have some conclusions about how not to be hindered in my criticism of things that I would criticize if I would not fear to be called an anti-Semite. That's one problem. And the other problem is, I think I forgot the second one now, I have to look into the text again. I think the other maybe is part of the psyop already. It has to do with the word itself. It is such an artificial construct. It is not Semite, but anti-Semite. But the Semites are not really the Semites, because the Semites, according to historical or whatever data, are not really those to whom it is attributed today. That's a whole conspiracy narrative. A conspiracy narrative is one of the aspects of conspiracy narratives is that they play with words in such a way, or they use words in such a way that You cannot follow what is related to what else. You cannot follow, you cannot localize the subjects and the objects in sentences, for example. You cannot say, you cannot have a clear understanding of the matter. It is on purpose complicated. It is, to give a good example, or a well-known, let's say, example, in this, that's what I mean with good. There is not one bullet, but there are maybe 8 bullets that were shot at JFK, and there were not one person, there were maybe 4 or maybe 40, and those were not down or behind the car or in the streets or behind the bushes. So you have 3,000 alternative parameters, and everyone knows if you have to count one and one together, it's more easy than if you have to take into consideration 3,000 other parameters. Or another good example is that you don't have just 12 victims, but you have 3,000. So anybody is going to say, oh no, that's too difficult. How can I ever understand what happened to 3,000 victims? So this word is already in this category of conspiratorial, I don't know if you can call it style, conspiratorial, maybe method would be better, because it is a method of creating narratives. It is a method of deception. It is a method of acting without being without being possible to others to identify the actor, the agent or actor. Agent means the same as actor. So that is the second problem with that. And the other one is, for me, and I will follow that one right in the beginning because it's easier to answer. It is the second paragraph where I already made the notice that I will come back to that. Because of that psyop, the anti-Semitism card has put date to any criticism or outing of any subject or any nefarious deed involving Jews, as it blackens the alarm raisers as Nazis. It's of course the aim, or one of the aims of that psyop, to avoid criticism of possibly wrongdoings, let's say, if Jews are involved. And I actually don't believe that it is 100% right, this conclusion, because it is not the criticism. I mean, let's take for that one also an example. There was the Nice truck attack. I'm just going to fakeologist.com/fakopedia, where there is a list of psyops. They are not all the psyops of all times, but just a lot of them. And the Nice truck attack, which was in 2016, if I'm right, 2016, that was something July, some national commemoration day, or was it 15? Bastille Day, was it? Bastille Day. Bastille was the prison that was opened and the inmates were freed during the first day of the French Revolution, as it is called. So, in 2016, on July the 14th, a truck attack in Nice, that is in South France, next to the Mediterranean Sea. For those who don't live in nice Europe, so please consult the card. I always have to consult the card myself if it's another continent. Yes, and several people were killed, and there was a Jewish reporter that reported this event. He was the first one who reported the event, And he was the one who made the footage of the attack with his handy camera. And it always bothered me that this was such a prominent hidden information. Even on September Clues, you won't find this information. Maybe they consciously tried to avoid this trap, to fall into the building with 77,000 maybe floors. That's called anti-Semitism. You just cannot make any step without doing something wrong. So the question with this reporter, whose name I don't remember now, but it's easy to find if someone Googles it or something, was that he was, maybe he wasn't even Jewish himself, but his wife was Jewish. And his wife was something in the Israeli government or administration, I don't remember even. So it made many waves, this story, especially in the German media, where he was then found out by the German-controlled opposition media, and he was really marked and accused publicly, and then he had to file a complaint against Gerhard Wisniewski, who is this other media guy. I remember his name because I have, I knew him already when all this story happened. And so the publicly debated possible, let's say, anti-Semitism of Gerhard Wisniewski was part of the PSYOP. It was implemented in the PSYOP that this reporter should be, let's say, able to trigger the criticism as a Jewish-connected person, at least, if not Jewish himself, so that this whole Semitism, anti-Semitism story gains ground in the public debate. And that is why I'm thinking that although the whole comment and its direction is of course true, it is more to it to understand it. We should, or I would like to have a more, an exacter, let's say, and not exacter, a more in detail understanding of how it functions and which part are really part of that PSYOP model. So, yes, I lost a little bit my line of thought. I repeat now the last sentence of that. Thereby, the Jews have been able to gain enormous world power and privilege. And that's where it all is again destroyed for me, because that is already again part of the PSYOP. Because, first of all, it is speaking of Jews. So we have, it is not about the difference between Zionism and Jews. It is about the difference to whom to attribute actions and to whom not. It's about the subject of actions. And the generalization, which is of course very easy, because in our day-to-day life we don't say, ah, the Christians went there and there, or the Muslims do pray, and they pray several times a day. So the generalization, not all Muslims pray, that's also known, but in this generalization, which is meant to just make the talk easier, or the writing, the text easier, there is a trap. There is a big trap that if you are analyzing a PSYOP model and a PSYOP procedure, you cannot fall into the trap. You cannot say the Jews have been able to gain enormous world power and privilege, because that is not true. Who has enormous world power and privilege? Let's see. Do we know that at all? If we would know that concretely, I don't know exactly who has enormous world power. I know some parts of it, and I can also say for with well articulated sentences why there is power in this part of, let's say, industrial production or banking systems or media. But that is very, very far, and I hope it is understandable. I cannot maybe I should be able to analyze it better, so to make it really clear that in this sentence that the Jews have been able to gain enormous world power and privilege, there is a simplification and a form of generalization which is wrong, and which is also an aspect of the psyop or of the template of historical understanding that distracts from the real question: who has the power? Who has the power and the privilege? How is it distributed? How is it controlled? And what can we do to distribute it in a better way or other way or whatever, or to change it or to stop it, or I don't know, that sentence is not important. So these are difficulties of the whole matter, actually. And I do not say that's important for me yet now personally. I do not believe that Genevieve, from what I am reading here, I do not believe that Genevieve does now in this sentence purposely equate everything that has to do with Jewish religion and history and blah 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 with world power and privilege. So it's not that. I just believe that it is very difficult to behave within this well-established and long-term build-up and running, but in the last 2 decades, reinforced and re-empowered and re-fired psyop, which is called antisemitism. And yeah, I think I make a break here and I'll be back. So I'm back again, and I have put into the live stream show notes the link to the post on fakeologist.com of Genevieve's comment on cutting through the fog. And now I'm going to compare or to relate this comment to a text by Hannah Arendt that is part of her book Totalitarianism. Just a minute, I want to look. The Origins of Totalitarianism. It was the American edition, I think, was... let me give you the whole parameters. And maybe also I can give you the PDF. The link, I mean. I have the PDF, but I cannot upload it on Discord. It's too big. It's a book, and I'm going to read only about 5 or 6 pages out of it. Here is a link to the Internet Archive where one can download it. I want to find the date when it was published. 51. The Origins of Totalitarianism, German Elemente und Ursprünge totaler Herrschaft, Elements and Origins of Totalitarian Rule, 1951, by Hannah Arendt. That's what is on the Wikipedia. I put this link also in the live stream. And what I'm going to read now is... Can I find it again? Because I lost it already. It's about the question that I tried to articulate based on the comment of Genevieve. I said there that the answer of who does this psyop or whatever we can call it. Maybe we should not call this one a psyop because it is such a big narrative that... is running at least since the late 19th century. There is also a text written by Joshua Gniatsko about the Dreyfus affair, which I have not read already. I am going to read that. But I hope that he has also important things to say about that. Okay. The first publication of the book in Ohio was in 1958. That's an important aspect because Hannah Arendt is a Jewish person. She is a person of Jewish religion, let's say. She's also one of the most important thinkers of the last century, the latest century. And she lived also the status of refuge. She was also interned in an internment or concentration camp, not for very long, but she had the experience. And so there are many aspects which make her very important, but especially she is important, in my understanding, for the possible answers that one can create out of her analysis of the Jewish, let's say, question or the Jewish status in history of the last period, of course, since the late 19th century. Okay, you can consult these links if you want to know more about that. And I'm gonna find now exactly where to enter. The title of that text that I'm going to read is Antisemitism. One has to take also under consideration that it is in that period of time. We have always to abstract the technological sphere, which is completely different than today. This has an effect on information, of course, and what can be known by one person in that period of time. The lead medium was in 51 was still radio. Television existed, but it was not as widespread as it was. It became the lead medium. Television became the lead medium in the early 60s, I think. I'm not sure about that, but I think it was in the early 60s. Okay, I'll recap a little bit. I was talking about a comment by Genevieve about the anti-Semitism PSYOP, which is which has the aim to hinder or to avoid criticism that would be adequate and that involves Jewish people. And my criticism was that, not to Genevieve, but generally, that we lack understanding of what exactly is this PSYOP doing, because we fall into every trap that is modeled by that PSYOP. For example, is it true that it avoids, that this PSYOP aims to avoid criticism to wrongdoings by Jewish people? No, it's not. It's not. It's a generalization that is not right. And do we have examples? I think we have examples. I think even the fact that Mark Zuckerberg is maybe a Jew in concerning his religion does not say that he is not criticized. That is not the real problem with that PSYOP. The real problem is maybe very effectively managed through the PSYOP. So, as I said, I do not have the understanding. I am just bothered by the whole topic and the thematics that it brings, and especially that it is impossible to produce somehow as a from a phacological point of view, which I say I have a little bit now, understanding of events that are going on in the world, and you cannot analyze. I cannot analyze them. I don't know how far goes the Israeli propaganda. How far goes the Palestinian propaganda? How far goes the Syrian propaganda? I know that propaganda can go very, very far. It can and does produce really events that are completely fictitious. But in my enterprise, let's say, to understand, I tried to consult Hannah Arendt, because she is the one who has produced a lot of material, thoughts, texts about this problematic. And I'm going to read now from chapter 1, the text Antisemitism as an Outrage to Common Sense. Many still consider it an accident that Nazi ideology centered around antisemitism, and that Nazi policy consistently and uncompromisingly aimed at the persecution and finally the extermination of the Jews. We are in 1951. That's important to have in mind. When I'm commenting, I'm going to say it so that it can be understandable. Only the horror of the final catastrophe, and even more the homelessness and uprootedness of the survivors, made the quote-unquote Jewish question so prominent in our everyday political life. What the Nazis themselves claimed to be their chief discovery, the role of the Jewish people in world politics, and their chief interest, persecution of Jews all over the world, have been regarded by public opinion as a pretext for winning the masses or an interesting device of demagogy. Demagogy. Demagogy is a Greek word, and it means to be able to manipulate on a massive scale. Demos is the public sphere, public political sphere. And ago means lead, control. So we have already here one point which we have to keep in mind, that there is a claim by historians or by public opinion or demagogues or whatever, that the Nazis discovered the role of the Jewish people in the world politics. We don't know that. There is a question mark. I just cannot skip it. It's a detail, but it is an important detail, I think. In her first sentence, Hannah Arendt says, many still consider it an accident that Nazi ideology centered around antisemitism, and that Nazi policy consistently and uncompromisingly aimed at the persecution and finally the extermination of the Jews. I made previously a whole comment on the text of Genevieve, which summarized and generalized in her comment with the words, go back, thereby, Genevieve's words, thereby the Jews have been able to gain enormous world power and privilege. And I criticized it here, saying that she generalizes again, that the text generalizes again and makes the same mistake that is intended, actually, by this antisemitism style, to put them all into the same pot, let's say. And in the text of Hannah Arendt, there is a difference, because here the Jews are the object in that sentence. Although it has the definite article, it is also the. It is not a generalization. It does not mean all the Jews, but it means the ones of this kind. It is the category, it is the religion or the other attributes that are related to this word that she is talking of. So she does not make this generalization. She does not fall into trap of any kind. Maybe because she is herself belongs to this group of religious adherents, or how is that called? But I wanted to make this comment. I thought it was important. I'm continuing with the text of Hannah Arendt, keeping in mind the first question mark that I said. If the Nazis really invented this story, we don't know it. The failure, Hannah Arendt says, the failure to take seriously what the Nazis themselves said is comprehensibly enough. There is hardly an aspect of contemporary history more irritating and mystifying than the fact that all of the great unsolved political questions of our century, it should have been this seemingly small and unimportant Jewish problem that had the dubious honor of setting the whole infernal machine in motion. That's quite clear. I continue reading. Such discrepancies between cause and effect outrage our common sense, to say nothing of the historian's sense of balance and harmony. Compared with the events themselves, all explanations of anti-Semitism look as if they had been hastily and hazardously contrived to cover up an issue which so gravely threatens our sense of proportion and our hope for sanity. This is really great how she is articulating that. And we have to keep in mind, now these are my comments, we have to keep in mind that in 1951, the whole anti-Semitism psyop that we know today, with today I mean after 9/11/2001, that's all today, that's the new period, the 21st century narrative clash, and in that period, in 51, or even also till the late 60s, the anti-Semitism psyop, I just take now the term without problematizing it more, the anti-Semitism psyop was not implemented as the one we have now. It is not the same template of psyop that was running then. The Holocaust was not big in any media. There was no... I'm not sure if the laws, for example, for persecution of Holocaust denying in Germany or in other countries of Europe, if they were implemented already. My guess would be that this happened in the 70s. Because there was a push of this psyop in the late 60s and in the 70s. I said that all because when Hannah Arendt is speaking about the claim that the Nazis discovered the role of Jewish people in world politics, the claim itself is unproportional, completely unproportional or improportional to the events that are said that this narrative has caused in history. That we have in mind that it is not the same template as today. It is that for some reasons which we don't know yet, we have not enough knowledge about it. Maybe some other people have, but the knowledge in the alternative, let's say, research community or the revisionist history are very placative. They cannot be taken seriously. They are exchanging elements of this narrative with just other elements of the same narrative 100% turned around. It's not black and white, and then it's white and black. So something is lacking there. It's real understanding that is lacking. And here I find it very enlightening to have discovered this text, because from the first paragraph I see that I repeat it, it's really important. The failure to take seriously what the Nazis themselves said is comprehensibly enough. There is hardly an aspect of contemporary history more irritating and mystifying than the fact that all of the great unsolved political questions of our century, it should have been this seemingly small and unimportant Jewish problem that had the dubious honor of setting the whole infernal machine in motion. Such discrepancies between cause and effect outrage our common sense, to say nothing of the historian's sense of balance and harmony. Compared with the events themselves, all explanations of antisemitism look as if they had been hastily and hazardously contrived to cover up an issue which so gravely threatens our sense of proportion and our hope for sanity. For me, that reads like a psyop analysis. I think if she were living today, I think she would be analyzing much better than at least I do. I don't want to speak about others. Okay, I will be back in some minutes.
If you like this audio and want to support the site in a small or big way, please hit the PayPal donate button on the side of the Fakeologist.com webpage. You can show your support for as little as $1.19 a month by subscription or one-time donation. Thank you for your support.
Hello again, this is Faith speaking. It is June the 14th, 2018, and you can listen to this that I am talking about because there is the website fakeologist.com, which has a Discord, which can be found through the website fakeologist.com, where you can join the chat rooms and discuss with others, or you can do, as I am doing now, your own presentation about topics that are related to fakeology. And if you find this a good thing, consider to contribute to fakeologist.com either way or another, either with financial or with active contributions or whatever you want and can. I'm continuing now with discussing Hannah Arendt's thoughts about the quote-unquote Jewish problem. She didn't have the Jewish problem in quotes, as I see in her text, but I put it in quotes because obviously it is not a problem with the Jews or of the Jews. Or of the Jews it is, yes. It's not a problem with the Jews. It's a problem of those who create the narratives, the historical narratives that that shape actions and thoughts and realities. I am continuing now by reading. I will just read now because I always interrupt to make some comments of mine which are not really important. One of these hasty explanations has been the identification of antisemitism with rampant nationalism and its xenophobic outbursts. Unfortunately, the fact is that modern antisemitism grew in proportion as traditional nationalism declined and reached its climax at the exact moment when the European system of nation-states and its precarious balance of power crushed. It's important, I have to interrupt the reading, because here is a relation between two things that is very important. Why is it important? Because we have the same thing today, for example, where xenophobic outbursts are attributed to rampant nationalism, or those who have it are called extreme nationalists. But in fact, this relation between xenophobia and nationalism is artificial, at least in the time where Hannah Arendt is writing this, the nation states are already in decline. Nation states are since when in decline? We have 1951 when Hannah Arendt is writing this. The nation states were created in 17th, that is the 18th century. They reached their highest, let's say, form in the late 19th century, and then they started declining. The first wave of the new, let's say, imperialism, the new empire grab for power on the planet, was in the beginning of the 20th century. So this is one element that is important to keep in mind. I continue now with Hannah Arendt again. It has already been noticed that the Nazis were not simple nationalists. Their nationalist propaganda was directed toward their fellow travelers and not their convinced members. The latter, on the contrary, were never allowed to lose sight of a consistently supranational approach to politics. Nazi nationalism had more than one aspect in common with the recent nationalistic propaganda in the Soviet Union, which is also used only to feed the prejudices of the masses. The Nazis had a genuine and never revoked contempt for the narrowness of nationalism, the provincialism of the nation-state, and they repeated time and again that their movement, international in scope, like the Bolshevik movement, was more important to them than any state which would necessarily be bound to a specific territory. Not only the Nazis, but 50 years of anti-Semitic history stand as evidence against the identification of anti-Semitism with nationalism. The first anti-Semitic parties in the last decades of the 19th century were also among the first that banded together internationally. From the very beginning, they called international congresses and were concerned with a coordination of international or at least inter-European activities. So she says, that's my words now, she argues, I think, is, or she states or tries to prove that it is false to see the reason for anti-Semitism in nationalism, because the historical elements disprove this hypothesis. It is not really that those who are nationalists propagate anti-Semitism, but in both cases, the Nazis and the Bolsheviks, they are actually internationalists. I mean, the whole story with nationalism, the nation states are in decline since 100 years now, and it is propagated maybe just as a tranquilizer for the populace. It is not a solution. You cannot go back to the nation state. You have international corporate state now. So, and it started in the late 19th century. So, it should be obvious meanwhile, but in 51, I think it was not so obvious. So, I continue with Hannah Arendt. General trends, like the coincident decline of the nation-state and the growth of anti-Semitism, can hardly ever be explained satisfactorily by one reason or by one cause alone. The historian is in most such cases confronted with a very complex historical situation where he is almost at liberty, and that means at a loss, to isolate one factor as the, quote, spirit of the time, unquote. There are, however, a few helpful general rules. Foremost among them, for our purpose, is Tocqueville's great discovery in L'Ancien Régime et la Révolution, Book 2, Chapter 1. I haven't read Tocqueville, just my comment now, but you can find his books and read him. He was an important author of the French, French nation state. Okay. One of the motives for the violent hatred felt by the French masses for the aristocracy at the outbreak of the revolution. A hatred which stimulated Burke to remark that the revolution was more concerned with, quote, the condition of a gentleman, unquote, than with the institution of a king. According to Tocqueville, the French people hated aristocrats about to lose their power more than it had ever hated them before, precisely because their rapid loss of real power was not accompanied by any considerable decline in their fortunes. As long as the aristocracy held vast powers of jurisdiction, they were not only tolerated but respected. When noblemen lost their privileges, among others the privilege to exploit and oppress, the people felt them to be parasites without any real function in the rule of the country. I have a question now in the live stream, and I have an information from Antipodin. What needs to be established is, are the protocols of the learned elders of Zion authentic? The protocols of the learned elders of Zion, table of contents, preface. Yeah, that's a good input, Antipodin. And you might also join the live stream if you want and have time. Same for is for you, Silverbeam. First, to the first question, the protocols of the elders of Zion are not authentic. That is my assessment. And Silverbeam, Hannah Arendt is not just mainstream history. She's, first of all, she's not a historian, but she is a philosopher, was a philosopher. And second, I find it important to discuss about this book. Yeah, because something is heavily promoted, it doesn't mean it is not important to discuss about it. We discuss mostly about heavily promoted books or narratives. Everything that we discuss here is heavily promoted. These are the PSYOPs, for example, are the most promoted events in media that we have to do with, and we discuss them. And therefore, I think it is not a bad idea to discuss also the thoughts of Hannah Arendt about anti-Semitism. As I said, I'm trying to understand or to produce some hypotheses. What exactly is the template of the anti-Semitism PSYOP that is running? And my text that I have consulted is the comment of Genevieve on Cutting Through the Fog, and the text of Hannah Arendt, Anti-Semitism is, what did she call it? Anti-Semitism, I lost the title now, doesn't matter. As an outrage to our common sense. Silverbeam, please join the live stream. We must talk about these things, you know, because if we, and I think these questions are important. A mainstream book does not mean that there is nothing to discuss about. That's, and Hannah Arendt is not just a mainstream author. She has produced some of the most helpful thoughts about her period of life. That's just my assessment, of course. Okay. Oh, that's a pity, Silverbeam. Can't you please get a microphone someday? Because you have so many interesting thoughts and you write all the time in the chat streams, and at least I can talk better than I can write. I cannot talk very good, but I can talk better than I write, so I prefer talking than writing. Writing is just too difficult and leads to many misunderstandings. Okay, so we were hearing from Hannah Arendt that the identification of anti-Semitism and nationalism is not plausible. That's what she's saying. And if we have in mind now that anti-Semitism is a constructed and artificial and implemented narrative of use for the powers that were in that period, it makes for me sense. It is very good understandable. The narrative was of use, and maybe still is of use, because of this transformation of governance, let's say, or jurisdiction, or what other word is there for power, from nation states to something else, which we are always trying to find out. We speak about new world order, but it doesn't say anything. What is new, and which order is it exactly, and who makes the decisions? That's something that we should know if we are talking about power. I'm continuing with the text of Hannah Arendt. Anti-Semitism reached its climax when Jews had similarly lost their public functions and their influence and were left with nothing but their wealth. It's also important because it is a historical element that is used, but I think Hannah Arendt will say it herself later. When Hitler came to power, the German banks were already almost Judenrein, that was the German word for without Jews, and it was here that Jews had held key positions for more than 100 years. And German Jewry as a whole, after a long steady growth in social status and numbers, was declining so rapidly that statisticians predicted its disappearance in a few decades. Statistics, it is true, do not necessarily point to real historical processes. Yet it is noteworthy that to a statistician, Nazi persecution and extermination would look like a senseless acceleration of a process which would probably have come about in any case. This is an argument that, argument is the wrong word in English. Argument in English means to fight with someone in words, but it has, in German, it has the meaning of to have a good articulation, a good sentence, a good proposition about something. So what I wanted to say is we have this similar proposition or thesis also today. And one example is Miles Matis, who is promoting this thesis that the analogy of Jewish people in higher power positions in relation to the populace of the world that is Jewish is too high. So what is he saying? We have too many Jewish people in higher positions that would be normal according to the numbers of how many people in the world are or really Jewish. And I cannot verify if that is true, but it is a propagation element. That is for sure. By saying this, it is propagating that Jews occupy, in fact, a big piece of the power pie, let's say. And that is part of the psyop. That is part of the psyop. And I'm continuing with the reading because I have later time to talk for myself. The same holds true for nearly all Western European countries. The Dreyfus affair exploded not under the Second Empire when French Jewry was at the height of its prosperity and influence, but under the Third Republic, when Jews had all but vanished from important positions, though not from the political scene. Austrian antisemitism became violent not under the reign of Metternich and Franz Josef, but in the post-war Austrian Republic, when it was perfectly obvious that hardly any other group had suffered the same loss of influence and prestige through the disappearance of the Habsburg monarchy. So I do recap this proposition she makes. The proposition is that The anti-Semitism PSYOP, in my words now, the anti-Semitism PSYOP rolled out after the Jews had already lost their social status, their prestige, their influence, and their power, that means. Persecution of powerless and power-losing groups may not be a very pleasant spectacle, but it does not spring from human meanness alone. What makes men obey or tolerate real power and, on the other hand, hate people who have wealth without power is the rational instinct that power has a certain function and is of some general use. Even exploitation and oppression still make society work and establish some kind of order. She tries to explain why could it happen? Why could it be so successful, this anti-Semitism stuff? I'm not so sure if the propositions are 100%, but it's a different historical period. I cannot understand it maybe so good. Only wealth without power or aloofness without a policy are felt to be parasitical, useless, revolting, because such conditions cut all the threads which tie men together. Wealth which does not exploit lacks even the relationship which exists between exploiter and exploited. Aloofness without policy does not imply even the minimum concern of the oppressor for the oppressed. Didn't understand that so much. The whole proposition is based on this writings of Tocqueville about the ancien regime and the hatred that the populace felt when they lost their power. But I think that goes too much into psychological stuff, which anyway is dubious and very subjective, I think. I cannot ascribe to this proposition. I continue. The general decline of Western and Central European Jewry, however, constitutes merely the atmosphere in which the subsequent events took place. The decline itself explains them as little as the mere loss of power by the aristocracy would explain the French Revolution. Now, that's understandable. The decline, she speaks of a decline of the European Central European Jewry, and the rollout, let's say, of the PSYOP that was subsequent to the decline. That makes sense for me. To be aware of such general rules is important only in order to refute those recommendations of common sense which lead us to believe that violent hatred or sudden rebellion spring necessarily from great power and great abuses, and that consequently organized hatred of the Jews cannot but be a reaction to their importance and power. And here is where she introduces a very important term for me. She speaks of organized hatred. I understand that she does not exactly mean what I understand today of that. She did not have a template of understanding, for example, that those who are the decision makers and produce the big narratives in which they try to fight out between themselves, the power holders have their own power fights, she did not have such an understanding of history. Her understanding of history was the Hegelian one of the thesis and antithesis and synthesis, which is a myth, which is a PSYOP narrative also. but the proposition that the hatred of Jews was organized, that is for me an indice that we can suspect, at least, that There was also an understanding of the normal people, let's say, not only those of Jewish religion, but generally the normal people, that they could feel that something is not just naturally born with this story with the Jews, but it is organized, it is centrally organized, it is a plan that is being rolled out and implemented. Okay, I continue. It's not so much anymore. More serious. Because it appeals to much better people is another common sense fallacy. The Jews, because they were an entirely powerless group caught up in the general and insoluble conflicts of the time, could be blamed for them and finally be made to appear the hidden authors of all evil. The best illustration and the best refutation of this explanation, dear to the hearts of many liberals, is in a joke which was told after the First World War. An anti-Semite claimed that the Jews had caused the war. The reply was, "Yes, the Jews and the bicyclists." "Why the bicyclists?" asks the one. "Why the Jews?" asks the other. The theory that the Jews are always the scapegoat implies that the scapegoat might have been anyone else as well. That's of course important, because scapegoat means it is a useless category. The scapegoat doesn't have any use, so you can take anyone to be the scapegoat, but it could not be anyone. It had to be this specific category for that narrative. We still do not have, as I say, I still do not have the whole understanding. Since this is now a comment of mine referring to this I and we. When I joined Fecologist in December, I was used to we, because speaking together means always we try to have a common understanding of something. So we is the imagination of the common result, let's say, of a discussion. And that is usus in my reality. And I was confronted with the aspect of everyone here saying, "I say that, I do that, I can that, I don't can this. And I thought, wow, they are so egoistic. They always say I. They never say we. And I understand now that, especially in the fecological surrounding, it is important to say I, because it could be then misunderstood if you say we. Or you could maybe try to take someone into a responsibility for what you are saying, or to attribute it to someone else what you are saying. So, okay, that was a little excursus to personal issues. I'm continuing here with Hannah Arendt. I repeat and recap a little bit. The whole thing started with a comment of Genevieve on Cutting Through the Fog, which was reposted on fecologist.com, and which I found very interesting because it was speaking about an anti-Semitic psyop which is hindering any critic which could be attributed to quote-unquote Jews that are in power or that are doing wrongdoings. And I'm trying to compare this understanding of the today, let's say, anti-Semitic psyop with the period of Hannah Arendt, which has written many, many important things about the last century. And I'm continuing now with the text. The theory that the Jews are always the scapegoat implies that the scapegoat might have been anyone else as well. It upholds the perfect innocence of the victim, an innocence which insinuates not only that no evil was done, but that nothing at all was done which might possibly have a connection with the issue at stake. It is true that the scapegoat theory, in its purely arbitrary form, never appears in print. Whenever However, its adherents painstakingly try to explain why a specific scapegoat was so well suited to his role. They show that they have left the theory behind them and have got themselves involved in the usual historical research, where nothing is ever discovered except that history is made by many groups and that for certain reasons one group was singled out, the so-called scapegoat, necessarily ceases to be the innocent victim whom the world blames for all its sins and through whom it wishes to escape punishment. It becomes one group of people among other groups, all of which are involved in the business of this world. And it does not simply cease to be corresponsible because it became the victim of the world's injustice and cruelty. Yes, there is now a big snake in that hole, what Hannah Arendt is describing here, because this is the element that one is confronted directly when within the anti-Semitism psyop, trying to anticipate, or how is it called, to anticipate the reaction, the possible reaction of a critic of that. That would be, they always play the victims and we cannot say nothing about them. They suffered here, they suffered there, they were this, they were that. And she is now trying to analyze why this is, in my understanding again, part of that narrative. It has to be like that. It has to be like that because that is what makes then the narrative effective against the self-victimization, the alleged self-victimization. You cannot argue, you cannot say anything. So it is a very effective narrative. And I'm trying now to think of maybe an example, because all this troubles my mind and I get lost in all the theoretical stuff. I try to find an example. Let's say everyone knows some people that are of this religion. I know some people that are of this religion. It would never come to my mind to ask them such stuff. What do you think about the Holocaust? That they do not live there. It's none of their business. They do not care about such stuff. And it is completely absurd. So this whole self-victimization accusation is only in the narrative. And that means it is only in the media sphere for today. You will never find it in real life. And if you find it in real life, it is someone who is doing propaganda, who is part of some outlet or part of some party or part of some, I don't know, some organization or part of whatever. Could make a criterion out of that to recognize who is part of an organization. In my real life, I mean. I continue. A fundamental difference between modern dictatorships and all other tyrannies of the past is that terror is no longer used as a means to exterminate and frighten opponents, but as an instrument to rule masses of people who are perfectly obedient. So here I see that she has in 51 she understood more about terror than I understand now. In 2018, terror is an instrument of governance. It is not some accident or some occurrence, or it is not incident. It is not an incident from its nature. I continue with Hannah Arendt. Terror, as we know it today, strikes without any preliminary provocation. Its victims are innocent, even from the point of view of the persecutor. This was the case in Nazi Germany when full terror was directed against Jews, i.e., against people within certain common characteristics which were independent of their specific behavior. What is she saying now? Regardless what dimensions all this had, and the question of the numbers and the Holocaust and all this, which, as I say, I say it again, she or that period of time, these historical insight was not given because also of the media, of course, because they had only radio and the television was not even very widespread. Regardless of all this, the situation that you have someone who says, for example, I believe in blue butterflies, and suddenly all those who believe in blue butterflies are criminalized, that fulfills the definition of terror, because there is no reason of that. And I continue with Hannah Arendt. In Soviet Russia, the situation is more confused, but the facts, unfortunately, are only too obvious. On the one hand, the Bolshevik system, unlike the Nazi, never admitted theoretically that it could practice terror against innocent people, and though, in view of certain practices, this may look like hypocrisy, it makes quite a difference. Russian practice, on the other hand, is even more advanced, quote-unquote, than the German in one respect. Arbitrariness of terror is not even limited by racial differentiation, while the old class categories have long since been discarded, so that anybody in Russia may suddenly become a victim of the police terror. And that's my comment now. We don't know the real facts about the situation in Russia. It is highly politicized. Every information is highly politicized and highly propagandized also from there. The numbers of the whole number stuff with the Second World War, and I think in Russia they attribute something about 8 million and in the West also about 8, I think. I'm not sure. But this is all with question marks for me. This is not the important thing, the important things of this text. But here comes something important. We are not concerned here with the ultimate consequence of rule by terror, namely that nobody, not even the executors, can ever be free of fear. In our context, we are dealing merely with the arbitrariness by which victims are chosen. And for this, it is decisive that they are objectively innocent, that they are chosen regardless of what they may or may not have done. That is a very interesting thought. I never thought about that before, and now not concerning the problematic of the anti-Semitism tie-up, but generally, when we speak of terror, one of the, let's say, frightening or fearful elements is that it can be anyone. It is against humanity. It is not against some person that did something wrong. Or it is this fascistic element that is inside this concept. At first glance, this may look like a belated confirmation of the old scapegoat theory. And it is true that the victim of modern terror does show all the characteristics of the scapegoat. He is objectively and absolutely innocent because nothing he did or omitted to do matters or has any connection with his fate. We have to remind now that when she is talking of terror, she is talking of state terror. In that period, there was no terror like the one we know today. We know that the today terror is also only or mostly state terror. But in that time, that I wanted to say she speaks about state terror, not about some, I don't know, rebels or something. There is therefore a temptation to return to an explanation which automatically discharges the victim of responsibility. It seems quite adequate to a reality in which nothing strikes us more forcefully than the utter innocence of the individual caught in the horror machine and his utter inability to change his fate. Error, however, is only in the last instance of its development a mere form of government. In order to establish a totalitarian regime, error must be presented as an instrument for carrying out a specific ideology. That is also very important. So, for example, how I understand that. For example, in order to establish the rule of quote-unquote the New World Order, whatever that means, I just want to take it now to the contemporary situation, to establish a concrete regime. That would be, a regime would be obvious. Now we don't know. It is not obvious who is ruling. It is a diffuse. Maybe it is because it's not yet fought out between the guys that are fighting it out. But in order to be established as such, to be institutionalized, it needs an ideology. And that's something... What is the ideology today, if we would speak about totalitarian regime today? What would be that ideology? I just keep a question mark there and will follow this for myself. Okay, I repeat the sentence and continue with Hannah Arendt. In order to establish a totalitarian regime, terror must be presented as an instrument for carrying out a specific ideology. And that ideology must have won the adherence of many and even a majority before terror can be stabilized. The point for the historian is that the Jews, before becoming the main victims of modern terror, were the center of Nazi ideology. Ah, that's interesting. And an ideology which has to persuade and mobilize people cannot choose its victim arbitrarily. Oh, okay. So what is she saying? She's saying that the Nazis as a movement, as a hijacked movement, or as a controlled, narrated, and produced movement, as whatever it was, it had an ideology. It had morals, it had rules, it had institutionalized thoughts about governance, about whatever, about wealth, about health, about all this stuff that are attributed to the states. And in order to have an ideology, in order to establish the rule, you need an ideology. And the ideology for the Nazi rule was prior to their reign. So, what she's saying is, it could not have been by accident that they were chosen as to be victimized by this narrative. In other words, if a patent forgery like the Protocols of the Elders of Zion is believed by so many people that it can become the text of a whole political movement, the task of the historian is no longer to discover a forgery. Certainly, it is not to invent explanations which dismiss the chief political and historical fact of the matter, that the forgery is being believed. This fact is more important than the historically speaking secondary circumstance that it is a forgery. That's also important. This Protocol of Elders of Zion was mentioned also by Antipodin in the live stream chat. And it is beyond discussion that it is a forgery, but it's not the problem that it is a forgery. The problem is it is believed by some, or it is played out as if it is believed. Actually, I don't know anybody who believes this. And we see, of course, sometimes in media or on YouTube or even on television, the ones who have television, the propagation of this whole thing is taking place. That's true, but that doesn't say anything about if it is in the real world. If it has a group of people in the normal real life that identify with this ideology. I haven't met anyone of this kind. The scapegoat explanation, therefore, remains one of the principal attempts to escape the seriousness of antisemitism and the significance of the fact that the Jews were driven into the storm center of events. They were driven, she says. We still don't know by whom. We still don't know. And that's the whole problem. Equally widespread is the opposite doctrine of an eternal antisemitism, quote-unquote, in which Jew hatred is a normal and natural reaction to which history gives only more or less opportunity. Outbursts need to no special explanation because they are natural consequences of an eternal problem. That this doctrine was adopted by professional antisemites is a matter of course. It gives the best possible alibi for all horrors. If it is true that mankind has insisted on murdering Jews for more than 2,000 years, then Jew killing is a normal and even human occupation, and Jew hatred is justified beyond the need of argument. The more surprising aspect of this explanation, the assumption of an internal antisemitism, is that it has been adopted by a great many unbiased historians and by an even greater number of Jews. But we know better, we know that this is not the fact, so. It is this odd coincidence which makes the theory so very dangerous and confusing. Its escapist basis is in both instances the same. Just as antisemites understandably desire to escape responsibility for their deeds, so Jews attacked and on the defensive, even more understandably, do not wish under any circumstances to discuss their share of responsibility. In the case of Jewish and frequently of Christian adherents of this doctrine, however, the escapist tendencies of official apologetics are based upon more important and less rational motives. Yes, I think I stop here with the text. First of all, I'm getting confused now, and I cannot follow the text myself, although I have read it, of course, several times before. I just want to recap, because if someone doesn't have the interest to go and read the book, at least to understand why I choose it, to discuss it, concerning and problematizing the anti-Semitism psyop. It is because in this text and in the whole book, of course, this chapter is specifically about antisemitism. Hannah Arendt describes and analyzes and describes the circumstances that were in fact contributing to the ability that this group of people could be part of that narrative or were chosen to be part of that narrative. So it helps, from my point of view, trying to analyze the psyop of antisemitism, it helps me to understand that it was not by accident, first of all, there were reasons, that it was part of the ideology of Nazism prior to the power grab of the Nazis, which of course were elected, but they also dissolved the parliament after the election, so it was a power grab. It doesn't still answer the question of who is, or who generally, not which person, but who generally is it that rolls out this psyop? Who is the initiator? Who is the author of that psyop narrative? That is the question I will discuss maybe later with others in another show or whatever live stream or chat. And for now, I want to thank you for listening, if you did, and have a nice day. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Wayfaring Stranger from Casablanca, Morocco, and you're listening to Fakeologist Radio on Fakeologist.com.